or for export. Emergent and Johnson & Johnson have both cast the clearance of those doses as a positive development that will help fight the pandemic. The memo said that the contamination discovered in March most likely occurred when workers removing waste from AstraZeneca's production zone tainted bioreactor materials that were being readied for use in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Besides the 15 million doses that had to be tossed out, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said an additional 60 million doses of the vaccine should be discarded because the same lax procedures were used in producing them and evidence of trace contamination might not have shown up in tests. There is no evidence that even a low level of contamination would have no impact on the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, the memo said. Even though the plant did not fully follow good manufacturing practices, regulators decided to clear 10 million doses of the vaccine, citing the continuing COVID-19 public health emergency. Those batches were produced under better conditions before the overloading of the facility's capacities and the transit of waste in the area that led to the cross-contamination, the memo stated. The agency also underscored the fact that regulators were concerned about Emergent's practices before the contaminated batch was discovered. In September of last year, it stated inspectors cited manufacturing areas crowded with equipment and supplies, inadequate support for quality assurance, and a need to improve the flow of materials and equipment at the plant. During a follow-up visit in early February of this year, inspectors were troubled by the number of personnel changes and new hires, as well as the need for more consistency in following manufacturing procedures, the memo said. The U.S. government agreed in May of 2020 to pay Emergent monthly fees that, as of this April, would have totaled about $200 million. A federal official said the Biden administration has not been paying the Emergent fees, which were tied to production of the AstraZeneca vaccine since about April. After the contamination was discovered, federal officials stripped Emergent of the responsibility of producing AstraZeneca's vaccine. If and when the factory is allowed to reopen, Emergent will only produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and only under Johnson & Johnson's direct supervision. A decision on whether the Baltimore plant can resume its operations is expected in a few weeks' time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia supported the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. Ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
What the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
At first, it was dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but now the idea is gaining traction and international attention. The coronavirus, or COVID-19, as it became known, may have originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. This was a claim that former U.S. President Donald Trump had stated, in which he received a lack of flak for calling it a Chinese virus. But what has led to a rise in this theory? The fact that the virus leaked out of a laboratory in Wuhan was never really dismissed outright in the first place. Now, a report on the origins of COVID-19 by a U.S. government national laboratory concluded that the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese lab in Wuhan is plausible and deserves further investigation.
My take is that the American government is changing its attitude from time to time and aimed more at being anti-Donald Trump and anti-China than anything else. It does not recognize that it really was a biowarfare weapon, as I and others firmly believe.
This was apparent when, as recent as last week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the intelligence needs to be gathered as to the origins of the virus. U.S. intelligence agencies are considering two likely scenarios: that the virus resulted from a laboratory accident, or that it emerged from a human contact with an infected animal. Meanwhile, U.S. government sources said a classified American intelligence report circulated during the Trump administration, which alleged that the three researchers at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology became so ill in November 2019 that they sought hospital care. U.S. officials have accused China of not being transparent about the virus's origin, a charge Beijing denies.
The U.S. moves to shift the blame of COVID-19 is no different from its lies in Iraq's position of weapons of mass destruction. The international community should be vigilant about this. I'm sure such moves will be rejected by people with insight. We urge the U.S. to stop politicizing the city of origins, stop smearing China, adopt an open and transparent attitude on this issue, shoulder its due responsibilities, and invite WHO experts for origin studies in the U.S.
Numerous questions arises out of all of this, and the one that clearly needs to be answered is, why is the U.S. president highlighting the results of the intelligence findings at this point in time? Was he not aware of the intelligence reports like during the time Trump was in power?
My take, again, is that Biden was and the Democratic Party were doing this as a result of their opposition to Trump and to make him look bad. He's now involved in investigating this because it makes China look bad. And China is now the new enemy.
Furthermore, the WHO at one point clearly rejected the hypothesis that the virus was a result of a laboratory break or to have originated from a lab in Wuhan. It even had a team in Wuhan to investigate this, and the head of the World Health Organization mission said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that the virus spread from a lab leak in the city of Wuhan. Now, after over a year of the outbreak, several Western powers and prominent scientists have publicly stated as woefully inadequate the findings of the WHO. They have stated that those findings were relied on data collected by Chinese officials. This has led to many to conclude that the U.S. is taking political advantage of this in order to gain points against China.
Well, yes, indeed. The U.S. is doing this to obtain political advantage over China, to paint them as an enemy, has ignored its own involvement in the matter in the past, and is ignoring its own flip-flopping over the last year and a half or so.
The U.S. and China are competing in several arenas on the world stage, from sensitive issues like Taiwan and the South China Sea to intelligence like 5G. The U.S. has labeled China as its biggest national security threat. Whether it would at this length to falsely level an accusation of this magnitude remains to be seen. It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was canceled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded, after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire, and there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again, and so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mona Al-Kord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. which was released days later. But the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances of past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election, when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, the Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the Youth Station, and I am Hassanain, and we have in our studio with us Sister
Zainab.
Salaamu alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Alaikum salaam wa rahmatullah. I am Sister Zainab. I am here in the studio. That is Brother Hassanain. You're listening to Youth Station.
Thank you so much, Sister Zainab.
Thank you.
I hope you're doing well.
Alhamdulillah, rabbil alameen. I'm doing a hunkadori.
People say that, you know, every coin has two sides.
Yeah. Well, people don't say that. Coins actually do have two sides.
Except it's the fact that people, you know, narrate that, you know, quote it.
Yeah.
Okay, so every coin has two sides.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, keeping that in mind, do you also believe that, you know, even our sufferings have a good and a bad side?
Obviously.
Like, can have a good side.
Obviously. There's good in everything in this world. Right. Even nothing is absolutely bad.
What's the
evil.
Good side in the bad side?
That depends. That depends really on how you decide to perceive it and your understanding of it and how you react to it. I feel like it's important for us to first and foremost understand the purpose of our creation, why we're put on this earth, to be able to understand why anything ever happens. And once we understand that properly, we will find out that hardships are an innate, integral part of existence. I mean, it's not even for human beings. All living creatures go through hardship. Like, imagine being a seed and having to, like, grow out of the heart of earth from that darkness surrounded by worms.
Why should we have hardships at all?
Why not?
Isn't it good, like, you know, without hardship, like, you...
And then what?
Ease and comfort.
And then what? And then, my brother, we'd be spoiled.
Why?
We'd be spoiled like a child who's been sheltered, super-duper sheltered and protected and put in a bubble, whose heart's desires, everyone's complied with all their life, and they grow up and they're like... the smallest inconvenience occurs to them, because this is alam al-imkan. Mm-hmm. It's the world, it's the realm of contingent existences, right? And they're bound to clash with each other, yeah. Right? And if a person lived like that all their life, they would inevitably turn into someone impatient, unreasonable,
right.
Self-centered, entitled. They'd feel like the world revolves around them.
As we know that, you know, these hardships and these difficulties that we face every day in our life, so these are pretty common and it's normal. So, you know, we have it, like, you know, it's natural. So now, what's the good thing in that? Like, is there any good thing in our sufferings?
Growth.
What type of growth?
Growth, just growth. A child, have you seen a child teething?
Yeah.
Hurts like hell. Imagine bone shredding through your gum and coming out,
mm-hmm.
like, after a year of not having teeth and, you know, being absolutely fine with it,
mm-hmm.
right? And then bone is just tearing through your gum and coming out. It hurts.
Yeah.
And the child, usually, they get a slight fever, and they get irritable and restless, and they can't eat, and they're constantly drooling, and they get little rashes around their mouth, and their gums are itchy and pale. I still remember that feeling of my teeth coming out of my gum. It was horrible.
Like, what, like, you know,
is any parent going to be like, I don't pull those teeth out, throw them out, I don't want my child to go through teething because it's pain for them, it's a hardship? No, it's growth, it's good for you.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
You know, like, people say that, you know, everything, you know, everyone has to do something, you know, everything has to go through something to gain something, to get something.
Obviously, no
pain,
no gain.
Even the charcoal, like, it has to go through years of compression.
To turn into diamond.
So, like, you know, I want to share this, you know, wonderful thing that, you know, I heard it from my teacher.
Uh-huh.
He used to say that, you know, when you go to a dentist,
yep.
you know, for your root canal or just getting your tooth.
Reminds me, I haven't been to the dentist in a really long time.
That's really painful, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you go for root canal or you just want to get your tooth removed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he gets out those drills and instruments that you don't even know. I don't even know what their names are.
Mm.
So he gets the drills. He drills in your tooth, and it's really painful. It causes you a lot of pain. Then he removes your teeth, like two or three, I don't know. He removes your teeth. Then after that, you've gone through a lot of pain. What do you do after that? You pay him.
Yeah.
You pay him.
You pay him for putting you through so much pain.
Exactly, right? Like, you don't curse him. You don't swear at him.
How dare you?
Yeah,
how dare
him.
You fix my teeth even though it hurt?
What's the reason behind that?
Because we know it's good for us.
You know, because we all know that the pain we're going through, that's good for us. Like, you know, like, in the future, I might have good teeth. So we bear with that pain. So, like, we go through that pain. So similarly, we need to apply this in our daily life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, when we're going through difficulties, we should know that, you know, as we said in the earlier episodes, that, you know, after hardship comes ease.
Yep.
You know, we should know that, you know, this pain might be good for us. You know, even, you know, the philosophy behind all these difficulties is that, you know, a person who has to go through, you know, more difficulties, a person who goes through a lot of difficulties and hardships, in the Akhirah, he'll have a greater position.
Yes, exactly. That's why I was saying that it's really important for us to understand the purpose of our creation and why we're here. Because if you believe in the fact that, yeah, there's an afterlife and every hardship, every difficulty I could possibly go through is taken into account by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and subsequently rewarded. Like, there's this beautiful hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. There are reasons, there are different reasons for, before we get to that hadith, for hardship, right? But it all boils down to growth. So basically, the reasons behind hardships from what we can collect from the hadith is, number one, chastisement of sins. Number two, to elevate one's rank.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, there are a number of reasons that we can collect from the Ahadith for why we go through hardship, mm-hmm. right? And it's either Allah wants to chastise us,
yeah.
wants to cleanse our sins, or
yeah.
He wants to elevate our ranks. Because the Ma'asumeen, the prophets, yeah. they went through hardships too, but they never
yeah.
sinned, right? So it's either one of the two. Mm-hmm. And both of that boils down to growth. Allah wants you to either grow here or grow there, right?
Yeah.
He either wants you to, wants your sins to be erased here so you can have Jannah,
mm-hmm.
or you have no sins, you will have higher ranks in Jannah in the hereafter.
Yeah.
And like a beautiful hadith from Allah, and Allah is so eager to create that for us, to
mm-hmm.
put us through that growth process that Imam al-Sadiq says, for a believer, even if they walk by a wall and there's like a nail,
yeah.
right, growing, sticking out of the wall, and
mm-hmm.
it catches on their clothes and it tears it. Their sins, some of their sins have been forgiven.
Yeah.
A believer has a nightmare and wakes up in a startle
mm-hmm.
and in a state of distress from the nightmare. Their sins are, some of their sins are erased. Hardship, every little inconvenience we go through in our lives,
yeah.
unless it's created, you know, by our bima kesabet aydihim. Sometimes I put myself through stupid decisions
and we need to understand
and crappy situations.
Yeah.
We need
okay.
to understand that.
So yeah, you know, now you see that that's the beauty of the of our religion, right?
Mm.
You know, when we believe in afterlife, you know, we know that, you know, there will be a time when everything will be all right. You know, when you believe in Allah, you trust in Allah, and you believe in the words that Allah says, Allah
mm-hmm.
subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, Allahu khairul makirin.
What does that mean?
You know, God, Allah is the best of the planners.
Yeah.
Because when you believe in this, you know, then certainly, you know, the things won't bother you much. You know, if I'm going through hardships,
mm-hmm.
you know, God has planned something good for me.
Yeah.
If you believe in this, that's the good thing.
Yeah,
of
it gives it purpose.
Yeah.
It's you give
everything
your suffering
purpose.
And I think that that's what helps a lot of us through a lot of the hard situations that we go through in our lives.
Yeah.
To feel that we're going through this hardship because there is a higher purpose behind it. Anything
oh, yeah.
that we do, when we feel that there's a higher, even for that baby, the mother is willing to watch their baby go through that suffering
mm-hmm.
of teething, of
yeah.
going through any kind of pain, because they know that there's a higher purpose. My baby is going to grow. My
mm-hmm.
baby is going to achieve so much.
Mm-hmm.
And they endure it. And they try to comfort the baby. So if we believe that, you know, whatever we're doing has a higher purpose in it, then I think we'll be able to endure through the hardships. And
as well, like, if we, you know, handle the small problems,
yeah.
like, well, then we can, you know, when we go through, you know, the bigger problems, as we said, it leads us to grow.
Mm.
And it will be easier for us in the later time. So all these things, you know, it helps us to grow.
Definitely.
So there's...
growth is really the biggest gift of life.
Exactly.
It's the whole purpose. You're here to grow and flourish and reach your full potentials and be the best version of yourself.
I think we have to turn all the potentials into actuals.
Exactly, exactly. Give me an example. Mm. We're coming toward the end of the show, but give me an example of a hard situation, a hardship that you later realize the goodness in it.
Okay, one thing I can say is, you know, if you ask me the worldly example, going through a strict diet and working out, you know, I was really working hard and all. It was really difficult for me, you know, not eating the desserts and sweets and all, you know, avoiding everything. It was
yeah.
quite difficult for
yeah.
me. You know, not eating that for like a few months,
yeah.
you know, when I got the results,
mm.
there was, you know, I was really
happy.
Satisfied. Yeah,
you're
I was
happy.
Satisfied with the results.
Yeah, but then you put yourself into that situation willingly.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes some hardships happen to us out of our control. We didn't ask for it, but it happens anyway. But when we trust in that greater purpose and that greater power that, like you said, Khair al-Makirin is the best of planners. We trust in his plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll find sooner or later that silver lining, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel, that half full portion of the cup. And it gives you such relief. You know, you're so settled. It gives you such a sense of peace. That's all the time we have for today's episode, by the way.
Yeah, thank you so much, dear listeners, for staying with us. And thank you so much, Sister Zainab.
Thank you.
So until the next program, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
The limelight.
Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars. As the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden joins long line of presidents to woefully undercount civilians killed in U.S. wars. Here's more. Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars. As the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. According to a Department of Defense report, U.S. forces killed 23 civilians last year during military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. However, the true number of civilians killed by U.S. attacks in 2020 was far higher, according to organizations that monitor such casualties. The UK-based journalistic monitoring group Air Wars, for example, reported between 34 and 36 civilian deaths caused by U.S.-led attacks on Daesh targets in Iraq and Syria last year. Air Wars also reported between 7 and 13 civilians killed by U.S. forces in Somalia last year. A December 2020 report by Nita C. Crawford of the Cost of War Project a team of 50 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs in Rhode Island found that at least 83 civilians were killed in 24 separate U.S. attacks in the first 9 months of last year. While the discrepancy between the number of civilian casualties in 2020 acknowledged by the U.S. and figures reported by independent monitors and media is stark, it was even greater in 2019. That year, the Pentagon claimed responsibility for 132 civilian deaths, while Air Wars and the Cost of War Project reported more than 1,100 civilians killed by U.S.-led attacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria alone. The dramatic decline in civilians killed and injured by U.S. forces is a result of a major decrease in overall American bombing attacks in at least six nations targeted in the so-called War on Terror. Air Wars estimates U.S. warplanes and drones carried out approximately 1,000 strikes last year, down from around 3,500 bombings in 2019 and 13,000 airstrikes in 2016, the last full year of the Obama administration. Hina Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project, blasted the latest administration to undercount the number of civilians killed in U.S. wars. Almost 20 years into our country's unending conflicts, the Biden administration joins its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians, likely all black or brown people, killed or injured in U.S. military operations overseas, Shamsi said in a statement, adding, compared to credible independent media accounts, United Nations reporting and rights groups investigations, it is clear that the Defense Department's investigations and acknowledgement of civilian harm remain woefully inadequate. The grossly inadequate official accounting for the cost and consequences of the United States' lethal actions abroad prevents meaningful public oversight and accountability for wrongful deaths and perpetual war policies, Shamsi added. Civilian victims, their families, and the American public deserve far better than this. Successive U.S. administrations have attempted to undercount or conceal the true number of civilians killed during the so-called War on Terror. Former President Donald Trump, who infamously vowed to bomb the Daesh and their families while subsequently loosening rules of engagement meant to protect civilians, signed a 2019 executive order revoking an Obama-era requirement that the Director of National Intelligence publish an annual report on civilian deaths caused by drone strikes in areas outside of war zones, but under U.S. attack, including Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, and Libya. During the tenure of the former President Barack Obama, who dramatically escalated unmanned aerial drone strikes, CIA Director John Brennan claimed that not a single civilian was killed by airstrikes in Pakistan in nearly 1 year period in 2010 to 2011, during which the Bureau of Investigative Journalism counted dozens of casualties. Obama, under whom U.S. forces bombed medical facilities, homes, weddings, funerals, first responders, U.S. citizens, and allied forces, also redefined the term militant to include all military-age males in a designated strike zone in an attempt to artificially lure civilian casualty counts. And the administration of former President George W. Bush, who invaded Iraq under false pretenses, end, under whom the majority of civilian deaths in the war on terror he started occurred, also repeatedly came under fire for undercounting civilian casualties. As General Tommy Franks infamously declared on the eve of the Iraq invasion, we don't do body counts. While such an attitude makes it virtually impossible to tell exactly how many men, women, and children have been killed by U.S. forces over the past two decades of unending war, estimates range from around 500,000 to well over 1 million.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
World with reporters.
Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this as the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters, advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden.
This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. to avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, and that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that, that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing, he's not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Maro Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meat through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Syed Bourizza, London.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US dollar annual budget. The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceedings of the budget, calling it an IMF-dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with a budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us a reduced share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development, and healthcare. The ongoing ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small, and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds, and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes, the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. 7 EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious that tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated.
People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say.
Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain, as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door. These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Is
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence,